This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Hillary and Bill Clinton are both deeply implicated in the genocide of Africans in Rwanda and the Congo. But nobody's talking about that in this election season. And blacks in the South American nation of Colombia block a major international highway to protest threats against their land rights. But first, the Black American condition, especially black people's relations with the police, is more of an issue in the 2016 election campaign than it was in the two previous presidential races when a black man was running for president. Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam has said there are some things he likes about Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. But Carl Dix, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, says that Minister Farrakhan should be taken to task for those remarks.
At Savior's Day this year, Louis Farrakhan said, "It's not that I'm for Mr. Trump, but I like what I'm looking at." And he was responding to Trump having gone before some Jewish lobbyist and told them that I don't want your money, I'm not taking any money from lobbyists. What hit me was the deafening silence from radically oriented people, including some of the people who had gotten up on stage with the Nation of Islam during their Justice or Else march in Washington, D.C., because I had to say, and I did say in a short article that I wrote for Revolution Newspaper, which is up on the website, revcom.us, what is it that Minister Farrakhan liked when he saw Mr. Trump? Because Donald Trump is somebody who began his presidential campaign talking about Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers and criminals, talking about building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico to keep immigrants out and forcing Mexico to pay for it. Then he went on to talk about banning Muslims from entering the U.S. His references to women have been just dripping with misogyny, woman-hating, and sexism. All of that. Then he goes to foreign policy and he says, I'm going to torture the family members of people that we suspect of being terrorists. And see, this is America. This is a place where the police brutalize, murder, and torture black people, Latinos, every day in cities across the country. But they don't do that openly. Well, here you got a guy running for president saying, let's do that around the world, too. Donald Trump represents the cohering of a fascist surge in this country, and there is nothing there to like, and anybody with progressive inclination shouldn't be seeing things that they like in it, and if they do start to like them, they should question them. So that's why I felt I had to author this piece, and then while I was writing it, I said, well, there's another question I got to ask the Nation of Islam, and that is, they did that huge march last October under the theme of justice or else, and one of the things they talked about was the terror that the police were inflicting on black people, a very important issue and one that we welcome everybody who's stepping out to build resistance around. But we have to say there has been no justice on that front. I mean, the police continue to brutalize and murder people. There is still a video several times a week of police murdering somebody, usually somebody black or brown, and we see almost no police being charged or convicted for these murders. So where is the or else? We can't just talk about something is going to be or should be done about this. There actually has to be action to back that up. And I don't see the Nation of Islam in the street saying this must stop, standing together with people to take this on the way that that's required. And look, as a revolutionary and a communist, I'm clear that it will take revolution, nothing less, to end this horror once and for all. And that's what I always tell people. I stand together with people to struggle against this horror wherever it comes down, because we have to stand up. We have to say no more to this. And by doing that, we have actually changed the polarization and the way people line up on it, opening the eyes of many who hadn't been clear that this was happening so that they could no longer say they didn't know, and also heartening people who knew it was happening but felt there was nothing that could be done about it to begin to show them that something could be done. And that's a necessary part of preparing the ground and preparing the people for a time when it would be possible to make the necessary revolution to end this. But just talk about justice or else with no or else really doesn't cut it.
You say that Trump is a fascist and he advocates killing folks worldwide, but Trump actually hasn't killed anybody yet. Hillary Clinton has participated in the death of many, many, many tens of thousands of people worldwide in her official capacities.
Yeah, exactly. You're raising a very good point, Glenn, because none of these major candidates for president of the U.S. have the interest of humanity or of the masses of people in this country at heart. What they are all auditioning for, from Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, is to be the next commander-in-chief of the empire, to be the person who presides over the crimes that the empire carries out against people here in this country and around the world. That was the case with Barack Obama back in 2008. And it's the case for all of them today. There is a point to noticing that Trump is actually the figurehead for a fascist surge. But the answer to that is not saying, well, we got to go with the Democrats because they at least don't talk about it as they do it. They do it just the same, and no one should get drawn into that. And that also holds for Bernie Sanders. And we have to say this because there are a lot of people who see the horrors that the U.S. does around the world and in this country, but they are being drawn to think that the way to deal with those horrors is to get behind Sanders because he represents a challenge to the U.S. empire and maybe a different way for it to function. And I can understand why people can get attracted to that, because these horrors are mind-numbing. I mean, you look at the destruction of the environment of the planet, and then you look at the Paris deal that's signed, which will do nothing to stop that. But it was done by the so-called environmental president. You look at the fact that police have continued to get away with brutality and murder, the continuing attacks on our immigrant sisters and brothers, attempting to take away the right of women to have abortions. All of this has continued to go down with the Democrat in the White House. Well, now you've got this guy who says he's some kind of socialist and he's supposed to be different. But when you come down on it, it does not reflect any real change. What it comes down to is there should be a little bit better shake for some sections of people in this country while the U.S. continues to plunder the world. Because you even get to Sanders' program about the health care that he's going to provide and the boost in the minimum wage and some other stuff. He's going to pay for that by taxing the super rich. Well, the super rich get rich and stay rich by plundering this country and the world. And if your program is to tax them a little more, you're presuming that they're going to continue doing that. So there's just going to be a little bit different distribution of the spoils. And we need a world where that kind of plunder is stopped. And people who see these horrors and hate them need to be acting for that. And that means definitely not falling for there's something to like in Trump, but also not falling for Hillary Clinton as the lesser of two evils, or falling for Bernie Sanders as a way to deal with these horrors. Because the only way you deal with the horrors is actually get real on what causes them, and it's the system of imperialism, and what's the solution to that problem. And the solution to that problem is revolution.
Well, some activists who operate under the Black Lives Matter banner might say that during this presidential election, there's been a lot more attention to the issue of police terror.
The first thing I'll say is there has been more attention to the issue of police terror. But why has that been the case? And that has only been the case because people took to the streets, stood up, and said, this must stop. That's the only reason there's been any attention to it. And that isn't just happening in the arena of the presidential elections. That's happening outside of it. But then when these politicians, and in this case, it's actually both Clinton and Sanders, because Clinton has actually gotten some of the mothers of some of the victims of racist violence, like Trayvon Martin's mother, Eric Garner's mother. She's had them actually campaigning for Sandra Bland's mother, while Sanders has had Eric Garner's daughter campaigning for him. And again, you have to say, all right, these people are saying they're going to do something about this issue, but you have to say, okay, what's your program? Not just accept that they shed some tears, which are frankly crocodile tears, but what are you going to do about it? And what both Sanders and Clinton say is that they're going to improve police community relations. Well, look, that's not the problem. The problem is that the police are part of a criminal injustice system that inflicts terror on Black people and Latino people as part of controlling people that this system hates and fears. So how do you improve the relations between them? That's like somebody saying the way to deal with slavery is to improve the relations between the slaves and the master. And you can't improve those relations as long as that master-slave relationship exists. You got to be acting to end that relationship. And in this case, going from my analogy to current reality, we got to be acting to end this system through revolution, because that's the only way to do it. And to my sisters and brothers who aren't one to that revolution is the way to go at it, okay, well, we can talk about that. But don't get sucked into feeling that the person who presides over the system and who will continue to preside over terror being inflicted on Black and Latino people by this criminal injustice system is going to improve that problem. Because the problem is built into the system that they're auditioning to preside over. And you actually have to build resistance to that system. Even if you don't see revolution as the solution, you got to be building resistance and not going for the seat at the table. As Obama said in his quote over the weekend, that Black Lives Matter got to stop yelling and screaming and go to get their seat at the table. Because like Malcolm says, when you go for that seat at the table and that cup of coffee with the master, you've actually taken yourself out of the arena where you can actually do something about what the master is doing to you.
And I must say, there is something profoundly distasteful about Democratic presidential candidates competing for the endorsements of the victims of police murder.
Yes, it really is, because here you have the representatives of the system that have put the police out there, that have oriented and trained them to carry out the brutality and murder that they do, and who back them up when we stand up and start calling out and saying that this terror is unacceptable, because we have not seen any uptick in cops being prosecuted, convicted, and sent to jail for murdering Black people just because we had a Black president. It's not going to change with Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton. So it is very cynical for them to have a meeting with the mothers or the children or relatives of people killed by their police, shed some tears with them, and then send them out to get the rest of us to line up behind them at the ballot box, knowing that if we send them to the White House, we stay in the doghouse, to paraphrase Malcolm.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. 6 million Congolese have died since 1996, when the Rwandan regime led by Paul Kagame invaded the Democratic Republic of Congo. 3 U.S. presidential administrations have been deeply involved in the genocides in the Congo, Rwanda, and elsewhere in the Great Lakes region of Africa. But no one is more deeply implicated in the bloodbath than Bill and Hillary Clinton. Both Clintons are strong supporters of Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who opponents say is the man most responsible for the Rwandan and Congolese genocides. Kagame's minority Tutsi rebel forces overthrew the government of Rwanda in 1994, which led to the death of millions. Claude Gatabuke is a survivor of the Rwandan genocide and co-founder of the African Great Lakes Network. He says Paul Kagame's crimes predate the events of 1994.
It's not been just 22 years. The bloodshed started in the Great Lakes long before that. In Rwanda in particular, it started on October 1st, 1990, when Paul Kagame and the RPF, who are currently in government in Rwanda, invaded Rwanda. And at the time, they were part of the Ugandan military. So part of the Ugandan military invaded Rwanda in 1990. That was 4 years prior to the horrific genocide. And 10 years prior to that, Museveni of Uganda, the president of Uganda today, lost an election and he went to war, fought a bloody war and seized power in 1986. And he's been president for 30 years now. When he came to power, he said that the problem in Africa is because of leaders who hang on to power for long. And this year he has seized power again through a sham election in Uganda to extend his rule beyond 30 years. And the connection between Museveni and Kagame and Bill Clinton and the Clinton Global Initiative and the foundation that is run by former President Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, as well as their daughter Chelsea Clinton, is a big supporter of the two. In fact, in the late 90s, when Bill Clinton was still president of the U.S., he called Paul Kagame, Museveni, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, and a few others, including Meles Zenawi and Isaac Afwerki of both Ethiopia and Eritrea, who are all brutal dictators, have proven to be brutal dictators over the last 20 to 30 years, the beacon of hope for Africa. On a recurring basis, Paul Kagame is invited to speak at the Clinton Global Initiative. And on multiple occasions, Bill Clinton has gone on record to support Paul Kagame in spite of the overwhelming evidence of the massacres that Kagame has committed and has instigated the death of more than 6 million people in the Congo and other millions of people in the region, including Rwanda, as well as today, Rwanda's training of rebels who are now going into Burundi to destabilize that country. And so the support goes a long way, and it is disappointing because all of this, of course, it ties to elections, as I said. It goes back to the 1980 elections in Uganda, you know, with Museveni losing an election and going to war. And in 1994, when Bill Clinton was asked about the genocide in Rwanda, Susan Rice, who is today in the National Security Council, she is part of the administration, she's part of the White House, advised Clinton not to admit that what was happening in Rwanda was genocide because it would impact the election, the midterm elections in 1994. In fact, on top of that, Bill Clinton later pretended that he did not know what was going on in Rwanda. However, there is documentation showing where he was making decisions to support the removal of troops, which was all in line with, again, Kagame and the RPF coming to power, because now documentation has emerged showing where the RPF not only lobbied and pushed for the UN and the international community to stay out of what was happening in Rwanda, to remove any foreign troops and to not have anyone get in between the two fighting factions in 1994. We have faxes and documents submitted to the UN by Gerald Gahima and Claude Dusaidi of the RPF at the time, stating that the RPF would shoot anyone that came to Rwanda to get in between the RPF and the Rwanda military at the time to stop the genocide and the horrific massacres that were taking place in Rwanda. 2 years later, in 1996, the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, was invaded, and the starting point was the refugee camps of Rwanda. This has been documented in the UN mapping report that was released on October 1st, 2010. And that report shows that the RPF and Kagame's military, as well as the Ugandan military, were deliberately going after refugees in the refugee camps, where they selected blind people, women, children, and handicapped, and killed them. So this was not a hunt for the genocide perpetrators. However, it has been forever where, you know, Bill Clinton and other world leaders have claimed that Rwanda has an exception and they should be able to. They have a license. Kagame has a license to kill as long as he can use the genocide, which I'm a survivor of, to kill other people, which is totally wrong. And so today, again, in another election, we are seeing where Hillary Clinton has been confronted with various issues of foreign policy, but the issue of the role of the Clintons, and especially the Clinton Global Initiative in the Great Lakes region, has not been brought up in the conversation. I think they should be challenged on that. The other thing that should be known is that a few years ago, even after the mapping report of 2010 came out and showed that the Rwandan military committed genocide in the Congo, led by Kagame, a couple years later, there was a rebellion that was sponsored, supported, and financed by the Rwandan military, led by the Rwandan Minister of Defense, General James Kabarebe, and at the time, the Rwandan military chief, General Charles Kayonga, as well as President Kagame's advisor, General Jack Nziza. The report was clear, and the U.S., especially the mission to the U.N., pushed as hard as they did, even, you know, a couple of years before that with the mapping report, to not have the report released. They wanted to hold the report back. It wasn't until the media leaked the report that the report was released, and there was a lot of pressure on the U.S. mission to the U.N. by the people and by the media. And the U.S. was reluctant to call out Kagame. Finally, it was so egregious that even President Obama was compelled to call Paul Kagame and ask him to stop invading the Congo. The U.S. finally, for the first time, withheld, not only spoke out publicly, but also withheld aid to Rwanda. Of course, it was peanuts. It was $200,000. Which is less than 1% of what Rwanda receives from the U.S. annually. Rwanda receives nearly $200 million a year. $200,000 was symbolic, but it was important at the time. And today, I'm afraid that without being challenged on the tragedy of the Great Lakes region, which is the second deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, it's a tragedy. You know, it needs to be brought to the fore. It needs to be brought into this conversation about the election and the Clintons. At least Hillary Clinton should speak on what her role is in terms of supporting and working with Kagame, as well as what she would do if she was president to hold him accountable. Not just Kagame, but Museveni and all the actors in the region who have taken part in massacring over 6 million people, almost 10 million people when you add the numbers between Uganda and Rwanda and the Congo and now Burundi. So it's that important, but it's that silent. And actually, it's a reminder, a big reminder of how the most deadly conflict in the world since World War II has been the most underreported conflict to this day. And this is, you know, the invasion of the Congo and the subsequent deaths of millions of people as a result of the invasion by Rwanda and Uganda. And in the international community's hypocrisy in dealing with various conflicts in various places. And then you have the threat of genocide in Benghazi, and the whole world gets up and they go out and invade Libya. You have Ivory Coast, another example, where there was international intervention and apprehension of President Laurent Gbagbo, the arrest of Charles Taylor for the invasion of Sierra Leone, not even for the crimes that he committed in Liberia, but for crimes he committed outside of his country, which, you know, regardless, he should be held accountable. And just conveniently looking away from these crimes and keeping it away from the eye of the public. So it's a big disappointment, and also very personal for me, because, you know, around these days is when me and my mother were being ordered to dig our own grave during that genocide in Rwanda that was so preventable, considering that there was a four-year war that led up to it that could have been stopped, even by simply stopping the support of the various fighting factions. So I think today is important in the U.S. for U.S. voters and taxpayers to know what the role of the various leaders in the United States and those who are contesting for elections have played in the Great Lakes region, as well as the role of multinationals in the region.
Hillary Clinton's defenders say that, well, she shouldn't be blamed because she wasn't in office. She was just the first lady. However, when the United Nations mapping report, which pointed to Uganda and Rwanda as being culpable in the genocide in Congo, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and participated in trying to suppress that mapping report. In other words, she attempted to cover up an ongoing genocide.
Yes, in spite of the fact that she cannot be held accountable for the actions of her husband as the President of the U.S., there are also actions that she took as the Secretary of State. And the biggest one being when the mapping report was released, not only she part of trying to get it not released, but also any engagement with the State Department at the time, which she was the leader of, about that report was either ignored or not considered. She did nothing about the mapping report that showed only the most serious crimes, and it was almost 700 incidents. And there were thousands of incidents, but she totally ignored that. And in subsequent years, and also previous years as Secretary of State, she did nothing to hold to account Uganda and Rwanda for the crimes they committed in the Great Lakes region. In fact, Uganda was found by the International Court of Justice liable for $10 billion for the crimes and the plundering of the Congo, and not a penny has been paid to the Congo. And Hillary Clinton was and is very well aware of that and maintained the $200 million that continue to go to Uganda. And I don't believe that there was ever any consideration of taking those funds and paying them toward the $10 billion that Uganda owes the DRC. There was no freezing of assets as has been done in other instances with other countries or other leaders. There were no travel bans. There was nothing done at the State Department when she was in office to address the issues of the Great Lakes region in terms of U.S. policy in that region.
The Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, as a former member of it, has said that human rights is the hallmark of its foreign policy. But how has that related to the Great Lakes?
It doesn't seem to be applicable in the Great Lakes.
There are more than 40 black members of Congress, most of them vocal supporters of Hillary Clinton, but few have said even a mumbling word about the ongoing bloodshed in the Great Lakes region of Africa.
That's correct. I attribute some of that to not the support for Clinton, but, you know, not mumbling a word about the Great Lakes region of Africa, to lack of knowledge for some of them, at least the new ones. And the others have, I believe, been fooled by the PR machine, which is very strong, that Kagame and the Rwandan government continue to run. They pay a lot of money to lobby and to keep a good image in the media. One of the representatives of Kagame, the company, either it's owned or at least was owned by Andrew Young, who was the mayor of Atlanta, but also the U.S. envoy to the U.N., a deputy of Martin Luther King. And 2 years ago, when Kagame had his supporters rally called Rwanda Day in Atlanta, Andrew Young was one of the speakers on that panel. The other is that the U.S. has had a number of officials, black officials, who were vocal and adamant supporters of Kagame, who do not want to hear anything about the atrocities that Kagame has committed in the region. And they're both Democrats and Republicans, Susan Rice being one of them, and Jendai Frazier being the other, who was on the Republican side. So some of it is ignorance. The other is, in my opinion, the strong lobby, but also their either personal friendships or other involvement with, you know, various organizations or businesses that are involved in the Great Lakes region.
How does it make you feel when you see Paul Kagame, who is responsible for so many deaths, being welcomed into U.S. universities and applauded by editorialists in U.S. newspapers across the country?
It's a mixture of disappointment, disgust, and also, to some extent, actually feel sorry for the people that invite him for a few reasons. One is because they either just don't have the heart to see the suffering of other human beings, or they just choose, for whatever reason, ignore that kind of suffering, and they don't see the lives of the people that Kagame has killed as lives that matter. And I just feel sorry for people that think that way. The other is they look at Africans and think, well, these are just Africans, you know, they're expendable. And I'm pretty sure you can't go to sleep at night, look yourself in a mirror and feel good about being around somebody as unsavory as Paul Kagame. But they do want or crave the limelight that he brings and the prestige. But what he reminds me of is the long list of other dictators that were welcomed to the U.S., either in the government, by the government, or by other institutions, including long-term dictator Mobutu Sese Seko of the Congo, who plundered the whole country, including people like Saddam Hussein, including people like Osama bin Laden and others. It's a relationship that is just not going to work out. It also reminds me of U.S. support for apartheid South Africa, where Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist in the U.S. until as recently as, I believe, 2008 or 2009. That's how it makes me feel. It's just a reminder of some of the darkest days, the dark side of just the hypocrisy of some of these institutions in the United States. But it's also a good reminder of the various struggles that have taken place in the U.S. to stop support for people like that. There was a big anti-apartheid movement here in the U.S. that led to the U.S. finally supporting of apartheid South Africa after decades of fighting, pushing the U.S. government to change its policies. So on one hand, the last thing that makes me really feel sorry for these organizations is that they're on the wrong side of history. And with current technology and people's ability to self-publish and things like that, they can't get away with it for as long as they have. I don't know if you had a chance to see previously when Paul Kagame was invited to Harvard. It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing, I think, not only to Kagame because of the questions the students challenged him with, but also to the organizers. I mean, you know, who brings somebody like that and pretends this is, you know, somebody who's going to give a lecture on democracy when he's one of the most undemocratic leaders in the world? also known as the greatest mass murderer in office today, according to Philip Ranchens, a scholar on the Great Lakes region.
That was Claude Gadabuke, executive director of the African Great Lakes Network. Thousands of blacks in the South American nation of Colombia blocked the Pan-American Highway, the major trade route that links North and South America, to protest threats to their ancestral land holdings in that country. Blacks make up the majority of Colombians that have been displaced by the decades-long guerrilla war, which may soon be coming to an end. Both the guerrillas and multinational corporations have eyes on the land that Afro-Colombians have occupied for more than 400 years. Charo Mina Rojas is an Afro-Colombian activist. She says the Colombian government has broken its promise to respect black people's right to self-determination and to land.
We have been in several discussions with the Colombian government and reached several agreements, including one agreement that was reached by the Black Women's Mobilization in 2014 to protect the territorial rights of black communities, not only in the Northern Cauca region, but all over the country. And the government has been dragging their feet and ignoring these agreements and really treating us disrespectfully. This is complete lack of political will to do anything. So that is one aspect of this. Then there are several things happening that threaten the territorial rights of black people in this particular region of the Northern Cauca, which are the government has the project of opening up that road, making it bigger, because obviously this connects economically the country with other countries in the south of Latin America. So they want to open up this road, and this is going to affect many, many, many families and communities along the road. We demand, because it's our constitutional right and it's a right recognized by the Convention 169 of the International Labor Treaty, the ILO, that we have the right to prior consultation and consent. Nothing can happen in these territories without the government and companies and multinationals, whoever wants to do something in those territories, sitting down with us. And since that is not happening, we want to make sure that that happens before any decisions and actions are taken that impact the rights of black people. The other issue that we were highlighting was that black communities are not participating on the peace talks, and not by now the agreements that the Colombian government is reaching out with the FARC, the guerrilla group FARC. This is a process that has been for over 3 years. We have been demanding the presence of black people in this at the table at the Havana, because our rights are compromised on these agreements, particularly territorial rights. One of the agreements that the FARC wants to sign with the government is access to land, precisely. And we know that most of the territories that FARC has interest in are around in or surrounded by black territories and indigenous territories. We want to prevent that people ended up losing their lands or in confrontations with these new inhabitants. So that's another element. The government, again, has been ignoring the demands of black people in this racist country where black people is invisible and they want to deny our existence. We are not being heard on this demand. Agreements are almost about to be signed, and we still are not at the table and making sure that our rights are respected. And finally, there is the issue of the safety of leaders and community members that act in defense of our rights. We have several of our leaders, women and men leaders, death threatened by armed groups, particularly paramilitary forces. Right, just yesterday we had few of our women leaders threatened again, once more, and we have been demanding with the government to set up collective measures to protect, ensure the safety of the communities and our people. And that is still is not happening. So we want to prevent that one of our leaders ended up being killed. So these are some of the main demands that we have and the reason we decide to call the attention of the government, touching one of those aspects that they impact them greatly, which is the economic aspect, because this road is very important economically for the country.
So you blockaded the highway. What was the government security forces' response?
Oh, that was a very violent, vicious response. We were attacked with tear gas, grenades, and rubber bullets. They were shooting us, just confronting directly. Several people ended up injured. The amount of gas that they thrown us was insane. They were so aggressive to the point that when we finally, some low-key level authorities came to try to discuss with us, to talk to us, and we were meeting with this government staff, they attacked the area where we were meeting, and even government authorities were affected by gas. So that was very, very vicious and very aggressive attack against over 2,000 people that was mobilizing, including elder and very young people, to the point that a 3-week-old baby was impacted by this gas.
So people are worried that black people's land would be traded away as part of a deal to end the civil war with the FARC guerrillas. One could argue that black Colombians have suffered most in this war, having been displaced in such huge numbers.
Yes. Something I want to point out is that black community in the Northern Cauca region is located in a very rich land. There is gold in this land, several minerals in this land, and so we understand that multinationals and the government has serious interest, and even armed groups have serious interest on this region. So we are concerned that people end up losing their territories because of these actions, the economic actions, but there are also military actions. The agreements between government and FARC, if the FARC is demanding these campesino reserves, as they call this demand, these lands, the areas they want, it's a risk because where the government is going to get lands in this particular region to meet the demands of FARC? It has to be from the campesino, the indigenous, and the Afro-descendant lands. Now, the main communities there are indigenous and black people. And since the indigenous have some laws that recognize the right to those lands, but the Afro-Colombians have been denied by the government of this right, we know, we understand that the main lands at risk are the black ones. We are very concerned of this. And what we want to prevent is precisely the dispossession of black people that has been located in these territories for centuries, since 1636.
Who are you demanding that the government speak to? Who represents Afro-Colombians?
Well, the main national organizations of the black movement have come together in the National Afro-Colombian Peace Council. This is the voice and the representation that we black people in the communities recognize that should be sitting at that table in La Habana. Now, we have made an agreement with indigenous, so we have an interethnic commission, and this interethnic commission should be sitting at the Habana to discuss and voice the needs and the interests of black and indigenous people.
Now, this expansion or widening of the Pan-American Highway isn't the first incursion into Afro-Colombian lands. This has been going on for some time.
Oh, absolutely. We have the same issue, for instance, and a highway that connects with the main port, one of the main ports in this country, Buenaventura, that right now is also one of the most dangerous cities in the country because it's militarized and completely taken over by criminal forces. And the reason is because there are also great economic interests there, and they have expanded this highway over all the interests and the rights of black people, and a lot of black people have lost their lands in these areas. And like that are other roads that are planned that we want to make sure we will prevent that that happens, because that affects directly the interests, the rights, and the self-determination of black people.
Colombia is the United States' biggest ally in South America. What culpability does the United States bear for what's happening to Afro-Colombians?
Well, the United States has a huge culpability on what happens to Afro-Colombian communities. You know, and people need to know that United States financed the militarization of this country for more than 10 years, and they continue in doing so. They put billions of dollars, over $8 billion, to threaten the militarization of the country. And that was Plan Colombia. Now they continue to be supporting the Santos government. They are involved, apparently, on the peace talks, monitoring and ensuring, accordingly with their own words, that the human rights are met in this country. But what they have done is the contrary. They train militaries, they put bases, and they were responsible for serious human rights violations against black people. They were responsible for some of the increasing and strengthening of those paramilitary forces during the period of the strong period where the United States was putting money on Colombia. There were the gross human rights violations happening, and all those violations were in black communities. Fumigations to coca crops, for instance, all this air spraying with products that came from the United States that have been barred in the United States, destroyed completely their farms of black people, cows, internal displacement. So today, the over 1.5 million people that we have displaced in great way is because of the support of United States to the Colombian government and the militarized policies.
So you're saying that the Colombian government is responsible for the security of all of its citizens, including Afro-Colombians. You'd hold them responsible for whatever happens to the activists who are threatened by death squads.
Absolutely. We made the Colombian government responsible for whatever happens to the lives of our leaders, to the lives of our people, to our communities, to our territories. The violations of our rights is a responsibility, direct responsibility of the Colombian government. Now, we also want to call the attention of FARC during these dialogues, and we want that they hear that we must be sitting at that table in the Havana. If they are really interested in peace in this country, all the main people involved in peace and affected particularly by the internal armed conflict as black people has been should be sitting in Havana. And they have also to demonstrate their political will to peace, demanding from the government and making sure, because it's in their hands and it's in the hands of the government apparently, making sure that black people goes to Havana and sit there and their voices are heard. That is absolutely important. And we raise the same issue with the coming talks that the government is announcing with the other group, which is ELN.
FARC has been at war with the Colombian government for decades. What relationship has there been between FARC and Afro-Colombians?
Well, unfortunately, lately, that has been a complicated relationship. There are areas where we have been declared military target by FARC forces, like case in Tumaco. And FARC killed one of our leaders in Tumaco, and they have to come out publicly to say they did it and apologize. Well, too late for that life lost. But it's unfortunate because this is a struggle over the land, and they want control on territories where black people is located. And this is one of the reasons why we are concerned that we are not sitting at the table and making sure our rights are protected, because we understand, we know for sure, and this is the reason for us to have complicated relationship in some areas, that FARC has interest in areas where black people is located. This is a territorial control issue. And if we are not sitting there, then we understand that our rights are in danger, jeopardized.
Does FARC, as a political organization, recognize Afro-Colombian territorial rights as a matter of principle?
Not really. They have issues recognizing black people as a ethnic group that has specific rights. And this is a racial issue. And we have that conflict and that distinction with FARC in general, guerrilla groups, because they tend to don't recognize the rights of black people in their territories. They tend to compete for the territories where black people is located, and they tend to don't recognize the specific rights and the specificities of white people in their territories. So we have some conflict there with those groups.
So FARC politically does not recognize that black Colombians have specific rights. The Colombian government on paper does, but violates them anyway.
Yes, that is correct.
That was Charo Mina Rojas speaking from Colombia, South America. Prison activists gathered recently at the University of Pittsburgh Law School for a discussion of solitary confinement. The panel was organized by the Abolitionist Law Center and the Center for Constitutional Rights. It focused on the harm and the suffering caused by solitary confinement in prison from the inmate's perspective. Albert Woodfox spent 44 years in Louisiana's Angola prison, most of it in solitary confinement, until he was finally released earlier this year.
I'm not going to sit here and lie and say I'm not bitter or not angry. I'm going to take 44 years of a man's life and expect it, but I'm going to use whatever anger I have, whatever bitterness I have, motivating factor to be the voice for so many that don't have a voice, to tell their stories and to ask people, American citizens, to take interest on what's happening in the institutions in this country, whether it's been, not just prison. A friend of mine once told me that when citizens and when the courts and when the legislators turn their back, and wardens and security people become judge, jury, and executor. So, when these politicians, they make it impossible for someone to go to prison to break the cycle. You come out, most of every state in the union have these laws. You can't get public assistance. You can't live in. You can't live in. You can't do this. You can't have a license to run this kind of. A lot of these people that are coming out of prison, unfortunately, they found out while they were in prison that they have remarkable skills. Now, society should have made them realize this, but it didn't. So what do you tell a guy who, I know guys right now in prison who have given back the death sentence by filing suits for guys on death row. But they can come out, and they can go to school, and they can even get a law degree. But they can't pass, they can't, won't be allowed to vote because they were in prison. So all the good they've done, it's like they hit a brick wall. So that hasn't changed, And particularly with American citizens, everybody don't want to be a victim of crime. But if you don't want to be a victim of crime, stop letting these politicians pass these laws that make it impossible for an ex-felon to get out and survive unless he committed a crime. Maybe one, if you get 100 guys get out of prison, at least maybe 5 of them might make it. Maybe they got a good family or good friends or whatever. But the rest of them, the strongest instinct in a human being is to survive. So if I can't survive within society, then I'm going to attack society. So So when these politicians start talking about tough on crime and all, let me explain to you how this works.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.